Hi, I'm Greg Lefebvre, and this is The Compulsive Storyteller, a series of short personal stories where we explore the idea that truth can be stranger than fiction. This week's episode is entitled Circle Jerks. There's a great new podcast from Consequence Media, The Spark Parade. Every week, host Adam Unz chats with artists and entertainers about their spark, the artwork that shaped their life and career, whether it's music, books, video games, or any other kind of art. By talking about the things they love, they share insights into what drives their work and style. Join Adam every Wednesday as he explores cultural inspirations with people like Chris Gethard, Bob the Drag Queen, Connor Oberst, David Borey, John Lovett, and Helen Hong. Listen to The Spark Parade wherever you get your podcasts. Circle Jerks. This is a story of how, as a young, naive artist at the beginning of my career, I was made a fool of and kicked around in a circle like a soccer ball by some of the top dealers in New York City. Looking back now, I realize these experiences were not all bad. They taught me some important lessons about the art world where I've spent my entire life. So let me go back now in time, over 50 years, to start my story at the beginning. When I made my first trip to New York City presenting myself as an artist, coming down from my hometown of Utica, I decided to stake out the Leo Castelli Gallery to see if I could meet the man himself. I had heard that he was probably the best contemporary art dealer in New York, having promoted and sold the likes of Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, Andy Warhol, and a host of other art world luminaries. He occupied the second floor gallery at 420 West Broadway. One entered the space directly into a large exhibition hall. At the back of the hall, there was a low wall behind which sat the receptionist, along with some clerical staff. On previous scouting missions, I determined that in the late afternoon on Fridays, he often came out of his back private gallery, beyond the staff area, to talk with the gallery employees, probably wrapping up the week before they left for the weekend. He, of course, worked the weekends, because that's the time when busy collectors were available to visit the gallery and to buy. One such Friday, I managed to get his attention just as he emerged from his private gallery. Being the Italian gentleman that he was, he did not disappoint, coming over to me at the edge of the low wall. As I gave him a short pitch about my art, he maintained a gentle, bemused expression and graciously suggested that I come back in half an hour when the staff would be gone. I was overjoyed that my plan just might work. A half an hour later, when I returned with my portfolio, he was sitting at one of the staff desks and beckoned me to join him in his private office. As I walked past him, I realized that he was a little guy. We entered his beautifully appointed space, with marvelous contemporary artworks hanging and leaning everywhere, amidst a few choice pieces of Italian antique furniture, and an open fireplace with a fire burning and a Dalmatian dog curled up on the floor next to it. He sat me down in one of two large overstuffed leather chairs facing the fireplace and asked, "Why don't we make this a civilized meeting and have a glass of wine while we look? Would you care for a glass of Montepulciano d'Abruzzo from a lovely vineyard I know?" I had no idea what a Montepulciano was and responded, "Sounds good to me," and our meeting began. He suggested that before he looked at my work, he wanted to learn a little more about me. Where was I from? Upstate New York. What had I studied? Philosophy in Boston. I didn't say Boston University, leaving open the possibility that I had attended Harvard. He seemed to approve of the fact that I hadn't studied art. How long had I been in New York? Just arrived. Then, feeling a nice buzz from the wine and the warm fire, I unzipped my black leather 3x4-foot portfolio, laid it on the floor, and with him standing next to me, I started leafing through a half a dozen unstretched canvases. I called them spinner paintings. A few years earlier, on the summer streets of Hyannis, Massachusetts, I had an outdoor booth with a sign that heralded Do-it-yourself modern art, set up with a couple of small centrifuge motors set in deep tubs where customers could use plastic ketchup squeeze bottles to squirt different color paints on small white cardboard cards spinning at high speed inside the tub. The results were completely unique with every painting, and to my mind, quite spectacular. The following winter in my parents' basement, I scaled up my technique, turning their clothes dryer on its side and mounting a rack to spin stretched canvases. I didn't share with Castelli that at one point the rack broke away and the spinning stretched canvas capsized the stepladder I was pouring from, sending me sprawling on some slippery plastic covered with paint. I also neglected to tell him that while I put down a drop cloth to protect the floor, I failed to notice that the flying paint created a horizontal band of wet paint around the entire basement, hitting shelves, walls, clothing bags, the washing machine, and of course me. My parents were not amused. Castelli stood beside me and thoughtfully considered each of my spinner paintings, seemingly intrigued. He told me, "I've never seen anything like them." Now I thought I was really getting somewhere. As we sat before the fireplace with our second glass of wine in hand, he announced, "Your art is very special." I beamed. "But of course, you know, I only deal in secondary market artwork." "Of course," I responded, hiding my disappointment. I had no idea what secondary market was. He continued, "There is, however, another dealer you should see, Lawrence Rubin at Knoedler. I'll give him a call tomorrow and tell him to expect a call from you." He then wrote Knoedler's number on a card, and with that, my portentous audience with Leo Castelli came to a close. I did some reading after our meeting and learned that the secondary market refers to art that has been sold at least once before, typically artworks by artists who have a substantial reputation or are no longer alive. In one sense, art in the secondary market has value that can be documented based on how much the work is sold at auction. My visit to Rubin was a step down from Castelli, even though Knoedler's multi-roomed, high-ceiling galleries were more impressive. After I checked in with the receptionist, he came out from the back, but there was no invitation into his private office, no wine, no Dalmatian. He simply had me open my portfolio on the floor, and like Castelli, he seemed initially intrigued with the novelty of my work. Afterwards, as I zipped up my portfolio, he said, almost parroting Castelli word for word, "Of course, you're aware, I'm sure, that we're only a secondary market gallery." Then he hesitated and added, "However, you should go see Alan Stone. I think he might like your work." Stone's space, like the man himself, were a complete departure from Castelli and Knoedler. His gallery on Madison and 86th was filled top to bottom, helter-skelter, with a mix of all sorts of art, from large African-carved ebony sculptures to lots of juicy de Kooning action paintings. When in a booming voice, Stone bid me to enter his crowded office, there was barely enough room for me, let alone a place to lay down my portfolio case. He loudly gave me a brief instruction in the main elements of his collection, and then he looked at my work. As with Rubin and Castelli before him, he was intrigued with my technique, but then the phrase, "secondary market," raised its ugly head, and I was shown the door. But not before he suggested that I should definitely see Sidney Janis. He would surely be drawn to my spinner art. The Sidney Janis Gallery was at 15 East 57th Street. When I called the gallery and told the receptionist that Alan Stone had sent me, the man himself came on the phone and said in a tough voice, when I arrived at Janis with my portfolio in one hand and a brown paper sandwich bag in the other, the receptionist smiled and told me to go right in. "He's waiting for you, and he's hungry." As the supplicant, I handed him the sandwich bag, which he ripped open in such a way that the bag provided a placemat. Then, amidst the clutter of papers on his desk, he unfolded the wax paper and carefully inspected his sandwich. After a bit of a pause, while chomping on his sour pickle, he said, "You did good, kid." So before we start, there's something you should know about Castelli, Rubin, and Stone. They're just fucking around with you. They play this cruel game of bouncing around some unsuspecting young artists between them, just to break each other's balls. I call them circle jerks and find the whole enterprise to be cruel and mean-spirited. I won't take part in their game, which is why I'm sharing this with you now, and I plan to tell you the unvarnished truth in return for my corned beef sandwich. So, show me what you've got. There was barely any place to open my portfolio. His office was much like Stone's, in that there were works of art everywhere, but in his space, the works were only classics of modernism. After we did some rearranging, I showed him my spinner art. He was very curious about my technique and asked a bunch of technical questions. Then he declared, "This is very original and solid work, but as I'm sure you've heard from the circle jerks, it's obviously not secondary market work. Each of the artworks you see around here sells for hundreds of thousands of dollars. No one will pay that kind of money for the work of an unknown artist. My advice to you is to keep at it. Don't get discouraged, and you'll eventually find a gallery. And here's the important part. When you do, call me up and give me the name of the gallery, and because I know everyone, I'll tell you what you need to know about the gallery." He continued, "There's three kinds of galleries in this town, kid. First, there are galleries that are in business to make money. They probably make up a quarter to a third of the galleries in New York. Secondly, there are galleries that are in business to promote someone. The whole gallery is set up by some wealthy individual to promote their kid, their wife or husband, their lover, their best friend, whomever. The gallery may have what looks like a full roster of artists, but the place is really all about promoting one special person. And with lots of money for the right gallery space, advertising, and printing classy invitations and catalogs, it can work. Finally, there are galleries that are straight-up money laundering operations. The art world is the least regulated business on the planet, which makes for plenty of opportunities to clean up money. A gallery may look successful, but if you did some forensic accounting, you'd discover that on the books, they make millions and millions of dollars a year, but not from the sale of art." Obviously, kid, you belong in a gallery that is in the business of making money. And my offer is sincere. When you find a gallery, give me a call. After he cleaned off his right hand with a paper napkin, he stood up, firmly shook my hand, then continued, "In a way, the whole circle jerk thing may be a blessing in disguise. You've hobnobbed with the great dealers, had some hard knocks, but," he said, and then smiled broadly, "you've also met me." I did call Janice a number of times, but sadly, every gallery I called about was not a legitimate moneymaker. In 1969, at the end of his career, Janice donated his entire private collection, then valued at $2 million, to the Museum of Modern Art with no strings attached. It was a fabulous collection that would be worth hundreds of millions today. It contained all the great names of modern art: Picasso, Cezanne, Matisse, Monet, Mondrian, Dali, and many others. He had a great eye. Sidney Janice was a brilliant dealer and a really good guy, as far as I'm concerned. Postscript. In 1994, Damien Hirst exhibited his first spin paintings. Their prices varied widely over the years, but in 2022, one sold for a modest $370,000. I did my spinner paintings in the mid-1960s, predating Hirst by 30 years, and when I made the rounds with him in New York, no one was interested. Right place, wrong time. I never sold a single spinner painting. I have no idea what happened to all those paintings. I wish they'd made it to the secondary market and into the hands of one gallerist in particular. C'est la vie. Rest in peace, Sidney. Are you ready to tell your own story on The Compulsive Storyteller? We're launching a new segment of guest storytelling, and we want to hear your stories. Email a voice recording to hello@thecompulsivestoryteller.com. I'll play selected stories on upcoming episodes. Try to be as clear as possible in your recording, and we reserve the right to lightly edit them for length and clarity. Leave your name or contact information in your voicemail or email, and let us know if you'd like the story to be anonymous. I can't wait to hear from you. The Compulsive Storyteller is now co-produced by Greg Lefebvre and Fadia Monserrat, who's also arranged the music and created the special effects. Emily Ramon does design, research, editing, and marketing. Peter Kakoma has made our theme music and for many seasons co-produced the show with me. If you enjoyed this week's episode, let us know. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at The Compulsive Storyteller, and we'd love to hear from you. This podcast is independently produced, so we really appreciate all your help and support. Share the show with your friends, subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and please leave a review. You can also check out our website, thecompulsivestoryteller.com, for more information. Thanks for listening, and if you didn't like this one, the next one will be another story. All characters and events portrayed in this podcast are based on my truth, with some names and facts changed for privacy. The conversations and dialogues are based on my best memory, but are not word-for-word recreations.